Hello and welcome to All Out Attack. I'm Harry DeCosmo. Happy New Year. I'm back with Peter Swallow. Happy New Year, Pete.
Happy New Year, everyone.
I'm good, thank you. Did you have a good Christmas and New Year?
Did. Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. Very festive.
Very festive. Back in England. Life back in England.
Back in England, no snow here, which is much appreciated. Yeah. It's actually pretty warm as well. It's got cold now, but...
Relatively warm over Christmas, considering.
Yeah, it was like 9 degrees.
Yeah. First game of New Year last night at Newcastle. At St James Park. Frustrating evening for Newcastle, but strange evening for me because I spent the night five yards away from Alan Shearer, which is really...
The worst places to be.
Yeah, it was quite strange, but...
Newcastle hero.
Yeah. So we'll get on with this second podcast. We're just going to pick up from where we were in the first one where we were talking about general things that aren't very time sensitive, if you like, and we're going to discuss things that what could happen in 2019, look a bit more further back at what happened in 2018, and really basically what can happen till the next time we do one of these specials, which we can't guarantee there will be a specific date for yet.
Don't think too far ahead.
No. So the first thing I really want to pick up, the end of the last podcast, I said that I wanted to talk about the Ballon d'Or, Luka Modric ending the duopoly between Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo, the first man to win that particular trophy. And obviously the FIFA Best Award, which replaced when the Ballon d'Or split, it's the other award that FIFA give out now. Luka Modric wins them both. First question is that deserved? And second is, are you glad to see the end of the Messi-Ronaldo duopoly?
It's an interesting one. It's difficult because... Is it deserved? Yeah. I mean, a fantastic year for Real Madrid. Pivotal in Croatia reaching a World Cup final, which is, you know, I know they're a fantastic team, but you still wouldn't have expected them to get that far. So, yeah, on the one hand. On the other, quite clearly, Messi and Ronaldo are still above everybody else. And that includes Hazard and Neymar and Mbappe and everybody. They are still a step ahead. So... It really depends on how we're going to go about defining. It's the same problem every year. How do we define who's had a great year? Is it via goals, assists, or is it influence on a team, on trophies? That's where the debate lies. So I'm not disappointed too much. I also think individual awards like the Ballon d'Or have started to lose their relevance.
Yeah, I did a video on this on my YouTube channel, which I sort of very sporadically do, last year, basically breaking down my opinion on the Ballon d'Or generally, how it's almost morphed into, it's rebuilt itself, these awards, these just generally individual awards, whether it's in, you know, the regional ones in Spain or whatever, or the Ballon d'Or, and any individual award that Messi and Ronaldo were up for, has sort of morphed, jig themselves around those two players. The criteria has almost become built around those two players. Inadvertently, no one said this, but built around a way to give it to one of those two players. Because, you know, everyone says, oh, you know, in 2016, well, Ronaldo won the Euros with Portugal. In 2004, Shevchenko won it, I think, and he wasn't, or Nedved. No, Nedved won it in 2003, Shevchenko in 2004. Nedved played in the 2000, didn't even play in the 2003 Champions League final for Juve, which they lost, and then Shevchenko wasn't at the Euros in 2004, but he won it then. So it was very much to do with who had performed better, who had performed well, who individual performances, rather than Messi and Ronaldo. And this year, I think Modric, to be fair, has kind of won the award at beating Ronaldo and Messi at their own game. The criteria is still the same, still built towards giving it to either one of those two players, but Modric has, you could argue, influenced games, as you said, and also won the trophies, won the Champions League, and helped Croatia to the World Cup final. So you could argue he deserves it anyway, because on both, whether it's just individual performances and how well they performed in individual games, not thinking about these earth-shattering defining things that the Ballon d'Or has since become known for. It's more about that now than it was. But Modric has won on both counts.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the Ballon d'Or has always been an award about who is the best player.
Yeah.
That's always what it's been for me. In which
does that
case,
does that mean Messi wins it every year, though?
Well, it means it's either Messi or Ronaldo. I'm one of these people that sees them both very much equally. I prefer Messi as a player. I think Messi is a slightly better player. But there have been seasons where Ronaldo has been better than Messi over the course of a season. More goals, more trophies, whatever. But I always view it on who has had the best season as a player. Not this. I don't even really count trophies.
So you go back to the Nedved Shevchenko era.
Yeah.
Thinking, so you would have liked to have seen. So does that answer the second question I asked originally? Are you happy to see the end of the duopoly? Because you would have happily seen. Because there are a lot of players who would have won a Ballon d'Or if Ronaldo and Messi aren't around. Xavi and Iniesta for two. Modric probably would have won earlier.
Yeah, I just think it's all about who genuinely, newly has been the best player. And that's the problem with the Ballon d'Or, is how people go about defining best. Is best ability-wise, or is best, well, he won this trophy in this team.
Well, let's do a little experiment. Don't go through every year, but if you take the last 10 years and you say who was the best player in the world in those years, who had the best year, not in that year, between outside of Ronaldo and Messi. Mm. 2010, you would have probably had to have given. You'd have had a straight shootout between Schneider, who won the Champions League and then had a superb World Cup with Holland, or Forlan, who won the Europa League, scoring twice in the final, and then had the tournament of his life for Uruguay. But you would never ordinarily say, if you were listing players in history who you think should have won a Ballon d'Or, generally, rather than specific years, you would never have either of those two players in that list, I'm assuming. You wouldn't think they are good enough, they're particularly better than a Xavi or an Iniesta. Because everyone says that Iniesta deserves it in 2010. Iniesta, if you actually analyse 2009-2010, that season for Iniesta was a disaster, both as a personal point of view and a professional point of view. It's about redemption, because he had the Danny Harke thing, his best friend from Espanyol, he died. Then he released. It's almost the feeling of redemption at the end of that season, rather than topping off a fantastic year. And it's almost the same as Xavi in 2008. It started with the redemption after the Euros, after a horrific season with Barca, and then, you know. But 2012, if you flip forward to 2012, Iniesta was superb that season, and he probably should have won it that year, rather than Messi. But as I say, the Ballon d'Or, as it was just one award then, there wasn't the two awards, they seemed completely stacked in the favour of Ronaldo and Messi.
Yeah, I just think as well, it's a lot of it's about what people see more.
Yeah.
People see goals more than anything.
Yeah.
And it's harder to, I think it's harder for the average fan, an average person, to quantify a player like Modric and a player like Iniesta for what they do off the ball, for the cute passes, for almost the pre-assist a lot of the time as well.
Well, this is what, you know, you can take that completely and say like, you can clearly tell, and like take Twitter for example, you can clearly tell who only watches Match of the Day and who's actually watched the match.
Mm.
And it's the same principle as that. By the way, I will mention that we are in a car, we're in Pete's car recording this, so if you do hear any background noise of cars going past or anything, that's what it is. But now it's stretched to, now that Modric has won it, that's probably flooded, you know. I don't think Ronaldo, I'm not saying Ronaldo and Messi will never win one again, but it's certainly never going to be a foregone conclusion that those two will be the top two.
I just think, particularly on these shores, and as well I would say in Germany, since Pep, there has been a greater emphasis on how teams play over the years. When you talked about 2003, 2004, the Shevchenko Nedved, there is now far greater emphasis on the way teams play, and we touched on it last week. And I think more people, more journalists, are now geared to looking at how teams are playing and how these goals are scored from a fundamental level, not just he scored that goal. We now go back, we go, okay, so how was that goal created?
Is that not bad news for Ronaldo more than it is Messi? Because Ronaldo, certainly in the last five, sort of 3-4 years, he's become just get in the box, score, get in the box,
it
score.
Is,
and that's relentless, and that's what's, but that's the word I would describe it. Forget like natural ability with Ronaldo. I'm not saying he doesn't have it, but relentless attitude is where I and pure effort is more what
it, it's bad news come for him when he starts Ronaldo scoring 20 goals a year.
As opposed to
50, 40, 50. Because the sheer weight of the numbers like that still overwhelms everything else.
Yeah.
Like, it used to be rare to see anybody hit 30.
Hmm.
You'd see someone like, remember Luca Toni hit 30 goals in a season, everyone's like, oh my God, that's an incredible year. And now, and then Messi's getting, I don't know, 80 at some point.
Well, the most legendary individual season anyone ever talks about is Ronaldo at Barca. Original Ronaldo at Barca. 34 goals in all competitions. 47 in all competitions, 34 in La Liga. And they did win a treble that year as well. So it is about, you know, individual criteria, not just of the awards, but also just generally how you quantify things. And with in terms of the thing that you mentioned, about, you know, I said about Nedved and Shevchenko, those players have they didn't. Neither of them won the World Player of the Year, which as it was, the World Player of the Year and the Ballon d'Or. Neither of them won the other one at the same time. And Michael Owen in 2001 didn't win. He won the Europe, even the Ballon d'Or, but he didn't win the World Player of the Year. So there is a sort of different way of going about it in terms of. Now I think it almost feels like a cop out if you don't give the one player two awards, which I think is wrong.
Yeah, I think that's wrong too. And I do honestly think that these individual awards are far less important. You look back at, we talk about great players, right? I mean, great players, Ronaldo, Ronaldinho, all the way back, even like Maldini, Beckenbauer, the greats, just great players. You don't think about them and go, oh, they were such a great player. They won three Ballon d'Ors.
No, yeah, exactly. Ballon d'Or. Well, Maradona never won the Ballon d'Or.
Yeah, like the only exception, in my opinion, is Cannavaro because of the unique nature of him being a centre-half.
Him being a centre-half, yeah.
And
being the
first defender to ever win the Ballon d'Or.
Yeah.
So he's the only exception. The rest of these great, iconic football players, you look back at them and you think they're a fantastic player. You don't think because they won X individual awards, you think because of how good they were.
Mm-hmm.
That always stands true. That will always be the case. So while I think realistically the winner should have been Messi or Ronaldo, I don't think it matters too
in terms of them being the better player.
Yeah, I don't think it matters that much anymore, really.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll change, maybe they will set out a new dynamic of guidelines of even being nominated. Because certain things like the team of the year, right? De Gea, I don't think, was even nominated.
No.
And you just think,
he's generally known as the best keeper in the world.
Yeah. I mean, for me, he is the best goalkeeper in the world.
But equally, he's not done much that you could quantifiably say deserves it. Manchester United had a terrible year.
But Courtois got.
I'm not saying Courtois should, but that's how it's sort of been. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. True.
That's how it sort of.
I just think until we have a clear guideline that is well known, that is in no way subjective.
Yeah.
These awards are never going to be as huge and iconic as they want it to be, because it is completely subjective. Who am I to say, if someone comes to me and says, well, I think Modric was a better player than Messi, Ronaldo, he did this for Croatia and he did this at Real Madrid and he did this.
Do you not think that football is much more materialistic now than it was in the Maradona days, in the Cruyff days, in the Beckenbauer days? Do you not think it's a bit more about the individual awards? Players are more focused. Like Neymar, really, you know, someone said something about Ronaldo that he would be disappointed not to win the Champions League, but he would be devastated not to win the Ballon d'Or. Which I don't know if that would be true. I don't know, but
no, but I think it's the exact opposite. I think back in the day, you weren't a footballer necessarily because of money. You were a footballer because of the love of the game.
Mm.
There wasn't a slew of individual awards either. There's loads now.
Yeah.
Each federation has awards, and there's there was World Player of the Year, the Ballon d'Or, there's XXX, there's different ones cropping up every 2 minutes.
I wonder how the Ballon d'Or's got to be in this sort of definitive. Because even before it became the FIFA Ballon d'Or in the time that Ronaldo and Messi have sort of taken it to a new level, it was still known as quite a big award. Basically, it is just a French football magazine
giving it out.
So you know, and journalists from a French football magazine. So what?
But I mean, that's the thing. I think now there's so many different individual awards. There's so many different things for a footballer now. There's the whole, we talked about Pogba last week, about football being a business. Neymar being an example of that as well. There's so many different avenues. They have their own individual boots. They have clothing brands. Whereas back in the day, even back for like Cruyff, there's basically one, two awards, individual awards, and you're a footballer because you love playing football.
Yeah.
And therefore, that award meant more because that's what it's about.
I watched Pogba closely last night. Like, I was on his, I was basically pitch side, so I was able to watch him closely. And what I took out of the Pogba, watching Pogba yesterday, was everything he does, when he gets the ball, it all looks very showy. Even the way he's running with the ball, the way he does everything is quite showy. He doesn't do anything, you know, this isn't a criticism, it's just the way he is. Everything he does is very sort of like, it's eye-catching. You know, he's almost playing football in an advert, you know, and that can lead to criticism, but he wasn't very good last night particularly. But he has been very good in recent weeks, and everything he does is very stylish, very, you can see why he's marketable. And the hottest take of last night's game, by the way, was the Daily Mirror's new North East sports correspondent Simon Bird coming in and saying that he's the nicest smelling football he's ever smelt, which doesn't surprise you.
No.
Because everything about Pogba is, the idea is that he is.
It's an image.
It's an image, yeah. But even like doing the simplest things, picking the ball, running with it, it all looks very showy. You know, there isn't very much function about him at all.
Mm.
And Neymar's very similar. Ronaldinho's much more very similar as well. Ronaldinho, though, you sensed it was for the love of the game. The other two, it senses that it's much more cynical. It's about the marketing. It's about, you know, and that may have led to Ronaldinho's downfall later in his career, in that he became more about the marketing, more about the, you know, one of the Brazilian journalists on his football's greatest documentary said he's thinking about what he does in the adverts. I have to do them on the pitch, and I think that kind of sums up Pogba as well.
Yeah,
and it sort of sums up the modern footballer, really.
There's different pressures. Different pressures now. You can't go and get drunk and be filmed in public. Everyone's got a phone. Everyone's got a connection to the internet. You can't do stupid things like you could get away with back in the 70s and 80s, and even early 90s, because not only will it be all over the world in a fraction of a second, you have different obligations now. If you are a Nike athlete and you are seen wearing Adidas clothing, that's your Nike deal gone.
Yeah.
That's a huge revenue stream. That's a huge, you know, marketing aspect. That's a huge profile part of you gone. And this comes from companies like Adidas and Nike, who find young players, who sign them up to lucrative deals in the hope that they become great. And they do that across all sports. It's not something like LeBron James, for example, has a huge Nike deal and did so coming out of high school.
Yeah.
A huge, huge Nike deal coming out of high school as a 16-year-old.
Mm.
So that's why football is different. That's why I don't believe these individual awards matter as much anymore, because Ronaldo's winning Ballon d'Or. Okay, well, I have a clothing company and I have a huge deal with Nike and I have this and I have that. And I can go to Dubai on the winter break and just do whatever I want and spend copious amounts of money. Whereas in the 70s, it's not quite like that. So,
yeah, I mean, I think I'm really quite happy that Modric won it, because it was a victory. It felt like a victory for football, not in terms of it not being Messi or Ronaldo, just in terms of finally a player that isn't, as you mentioned at the start, who's getting the assists from the assists, and he's not getting the most goals. Not, you couldn't look at us, because I always said this at the time, you know, when Modric was at Spurs, if you're doing fantasy football, he's one of the worst players to pick because he wasn't going to get your points.
Yeah.
If you look at statistics, you know, and charts and things, he's not top of the goals, he's not top of the assists, but he's probably the best player on the pitch.
Yeah.
And that is why it feels like a victory that he won the Ballon d'Or, and also it feels now like it's back to what it was before, where it's actually more of a level playing field. Because of course that's also helped by the fact that both Ronaldo and Messi are now over 30 and aging and not as good as they once were, and certainly in the terms of Ronaldo, because he's changed his game a lot more than Messi has. I think Messi is still probably is still prolonging his peak. But
Messi's truer to the way he was as a 17, 18 year old than Ronaldo.
Yeah. Ronaldo was a completely different player now.
Yeah.
But you know, in terms of how,
even then you could argue that makes that you could argue that's more impressive for Ronaldo. To adapt
and still
completely
yeah.
and continue to dominate.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things. Their time, I don't think their time of dominating these awards, generally speaking, is done yet.
No.
But it's four or five years.
But it's not a duopoly anymore, is what I mean. It's that you can't see them winning every trophy, every award for the next four or 5 years.
I think you'll start seeing Neymar and Mbappe, but probably.
You know, from the Ballon d'Or, I want to look ahead to 2019, 2020. Mm. 2020 is obviously a big year. We will hopefully try and do, you know, a few specials in the future again. And by the way, if you can't find the... I did tell you this after the last time when I was editing this. I might have had to have deleted a number of the episodes off the Podomatic account because the storage was... They wanted me to upgrade the storage and it would have cost a lot of money, so I had to delete a lot of episodes. So if you can't find them, we are sorry. But we needed to make room for these more updated specials because those, as you can probably knowing, having listened to the backlog, 2.5 years is a long time in football, like we said last time. So that doesn't really, they don't really stand up as well as they once did. But looking forward to 2019 and 2020 and, you know, the future, what sort of things, from a personal and a general football idea, would you like to see happen?
I would like to see a continuation in terms of English football embracing this style of play that's hit these shores, be it the complete adoption of the Pep model, of Klopp, of whoever else comes along and has a Sarri ball, whatever it is, this new wave of football that we've had the past few years. I think it's beneficial to English football. I think it's beneficial to English players. Not only younger players, but people like Kyle Walker, etc., Raheem Sterling, who are involved with these managers with these different philosophies of playing.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see that type of thing continue. Personally, I'd like to see England win a trophy, even if it's the Nations League. History may look back at that and say, like, oh, what an important award that was. If we're talking like if it goes on for 20 years, or I could say, oh, that was fun for a couple of years, and it means virtually nothing. But everybody talks about the importance of getting a trophy under your belt.
You can only win what you've got, what's in front of you.
Exactly. So I'd like to see England. I'm sure we will take the Nations League seriously. We've got a tough game against the Dutch. It's two legs, right?
I'm not sure. They're both in Portugal. It's like a mini tournament in Portugal.
Yeah. So
the final's on my birthday on the 9th of June.
So I'd like to see England take that seriously. I'm sure they will. And most importantly for me, I'd like to see English players, young players, go abroad. I think Jadon Sancho and Reece Nelson and a lot of these players have opened everybody's eyes to the fact that, yeah, you can go abroad, you're not going to disappear off the radar, you're not going to be... Because I believe that was the perception. I'll never get picked for England if I go and play in Italy or Germany.
Which is it's quite a strange attitude to have, given that that's never ever been the case before.
No.
Only Beckham with LA Galaxy was mooted as being a reason, but that was because he was playing for LA Galaxy in the MLS. It wasn't because he was abroad.
Yeah, yeah.
It was the level that was the problem, not the country.
And like that's it. I think these younger English players need to start seeing their worth. Callum Hudson-Odoi needs to look at Chelsea and say, if I'm not going to start playing, all right, I'm not going to play every game at Bayern, but they're more likely to give me a chance.
Hmm.
And being a bit more forceful and saying, yeah, I will go. Because what's there to lose now?
Mm.
So I think that's the kind of trend I'd like to see continue, basically as it has been. More competitive Premier League, which is, I think, the case now with Spurs. I think Arsenal will be stronger next year. Chelsea obviously have strengthened too.
Continuing on from what we said about last week, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer made history becoming the first Manchester United manager and the only Manchester United manager since Matt Busby to win his first four games in charge. But Pochettino is still likely to be their first choice in the summer.
Yep.
If Pochettino goes to Manchester United in the summer, do Spurs, we didn't really touch on this last week, how do Spurs recover and where do they go if that happens?
In terms of a managerial appointment, I don't know. But they've signed a lot of the big players to long-term contracts.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume their desire to stay would be influenced on if Pochettino left.
Yeah.
But if we work on the assumption that Pochettino leaves but the players don't, they'll still be a competitive
mm-hmm.
team fighting for Premier League titles.
Yeah.
The problem with Spurs is that they have games like they did against Wolves.
Yeah.
Where
Watford again.
Yeah, where they drop points that they shouldn't. And particularly now, particularly with City, particularly with this Liverpool team who are looking fantastic and who, you know, are unbeaten.
At the time we're recording, that game is tonight at the Etihad. Yeah. We won't be talking about it because this will be coming out on Friday and hopefully longevity and things. We don't want to really discuss that.
But in this type of era where there's at least one team like City last year who barely make a mistake, looks like Liverpool barely make a mistake this year, you can't afford to be dropping points like that. The only points you can afford to drop is to one of those rivals, and then you have to beat them in the second return fixture. Yeah, yeah. So, but they'll continue to be strong. They have great players. They have arguably one of the strongest starting 11s of any team in the Premier League. They just don't have a huge amount of strength and depth yet.
Was that affected by the summer and the wage structure still problematic at Spurs?
Yeah, I just don't see them doing what, for example, Chelsea have done with Pulisic and literally just going in and spending 55 odd million. Maybe that's just my perception because Spurs have never done that, really.
No.
But I don't see them going in and spending huge amounts of money on these players. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but when everyone else is doing it, and if everyone else is doing it in the right manner in terms of quality, they're going to struggle. They just are. There's only so many times you can look to the lower divisions and look to your own setup and find like incredible gems.
Yeah.
Like Dele Alli, like Harry Kane, these type of players. You're going to get more misses than you are hits with that mm-hmm. type of thing.
Yeah.
And so unless Daniel Levy decides we are now going to identify targets that we want of top quality targets and we're going to compete for their signature with the likes of Chelsea who'll spend 60, United who'll spend 80 to 100 to over 100, you know, like huge clubs. Unless they decide that they can do that and compete with that, I'm not sure they'll win a Premier League.
They seem to be similar in terms of spending power and what their choices are. The choices have been better than Everton's, don't get me wrong, but similar to Everton in terms of how much they've spent and you know, their record. I mean, when Moussa Sissoko left Newcastle for Spurs, he became their record signing, which is crazy when you consider what, 30 million in today's market, which is, this was only 2 years ago, in today's market gets you now. You know, I mean, I think that same summer, if not just before, hadn't Yannick Bolasie gone to Everton for £30 million?
Yeah.
And Spurs went and obviously paid 45 for Sigurdsson. Sorry, Everton paid 45 million for Sigurdsson. So what have Spurs been able to do, and would they continue to do it if after Pochettino left, that Everton haven't?
Yeah, I think so. I think they've always been good at identifying players, even before. That was before Pochettino as well. You know, like Modric and Bale, these type of players they've had in abundance.
That's really Kevin Keegan about Modric though. Well, should have joined Newcastle.
Well, yeah. We'll skip over that little side note to this story.
Tony Jimenez. You know, it's in Kevin Keegan's book. Tony Jimenez was sat in a meeting with Modric's agent and said, I think it'd be too small for the Premier League, and that's why he didn't sign for Newcastle.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Stupid.
No.
But they've always been good at identifying players. I imagine that will continue. Pochettino gets them closer to cities and Liverpools of this world than I think any other manager would. And also Spurs still aren't a big club, quote unquote, in that I still don't think a lot of elite level managers think of them as a competing club.
There's the report that Adrian Rabiot will turn down Spurs because he thinks that they're below him. And there was that whole thing that we always had that running joke around 2012 with the Brazil national team, didn't we? With the,
yeah.
Everyone was sort of looking at like Leandro Damião and said, oh, who are you linked with? Oh, I'm linked with Barcelona, I'm linked with Real Madrid. Who are you linked with, Leandro? You would go Spurs, and it would be like a bit of a joke.
Mm.
And Angel Di Maria didn't want to join Spurs as part of the Bale deal, reportedly. So there is this sort of stigma around Tottenham,
yeah,
that they aren't, that they have punched over the above their weight,
and that,
because
that's,
maybe
it's changing.
Because of Pochettino,
it's changing. You mean the way they play at the Camp Nou, for example, the way they played at, I guess the Allianz Stadium now, but the Juventus Stadium at the time.
Yeah,
you know, these performances don't go unnoticed,
mm-hmm.
and Spurs will not be an easy game for anybody, but until they do it consistently on a very consistent basis, until they're finishing either second or third, or even, you know, win a title, but until they're very, very close and competitive up to the last couple of weeks, they're not going to be viewed in the same bracket as Chelsea, as City, Liverpool, United.
That's the situation. This is the same conversation we've had about Arsenal, we've had this about Liverpool before. We probably would have had it about Man City around the time of 2010-11 time, you know, before they made that. Man City seemed to make the transition a lot easier, maybe because the Premier League was a lot more simplistic back then. Liverpool weren't the force that they are. Man United were the only force, really, because Chelsea were struggling. Arsenal were in the middle of the transition. That year that Man City jumped into winning that title in 2012, you know, Newcastle finished fifth that season because there was so much transition going around them. That doesn't really happen now. Every team around them is a force, except maybe Man United, but they would be a force,
yeah,
for Pochettino.
It goes back to that point I made before. They're not going to get a perfect storm.
Yeah.
They're not going to get Liverpool being terrible, City being terrible, United being bad, Arsenal being Arsenal, and Chelsea being below par. That's
funny
not
enough, that's what
that
Leicester
happened
got.
With Leicester. That's what,
yeah,
Leicester got. They've missed that chance.
Yeah.
So now, if Liverpool have a bad season, well, City will go,
yeah,
virtually unbeaten, or vice versa. United will always be a strong side. It'll always be a side that'll take points off you. And I think in the next few years we'll be back to competing for titles, regardless of who they have, because the team's too good.
Mm-hmm.
The team is a great team still. Chelsea under Sarri will be a horrendous game for anybody. They'll continue to buy. I said, I already got Pulisic. And if they get a consistent striker, a really high-level striker, they'll be deadly. Spurs are not going to have an opportunity where they're all going to drop points. Where less, like, it's not going to happen again. So they'll be competitive. I don't see Spurs winning it. Pochettino will be crucial to that. If he goes to United, will he make them win a title? I'm not sure.
So who wins the title at the end of the season then?
This
Bearing
year?
In mind we're talking about this before the big game at the Etihad.
For some reason, you know, I have a sneaky feeling City still win it.
I think so as well.
And I don't know why. That could be rendered completely stupid by the end of this evening.
Of course, we are taking a huge risk by saying this because this episode's going out tomorrow and after the result has been said. But at the time that we're speaking, I was watching them against Everton over, I think it was, I don't know what day it was it, but just over Christmas, I think it was the 15th of December. Last month I was watching them. And Everton started brilliantly there. They played really well for the first 15 minutes. Then City scored, and it was like, that was it. And it's very, I don't get the sense, even now, that Liverpool can keep that up and be like that yet. There's still a sense that Liverpool will mess this up at some stage. But every team has to go. Every team who wins the title for the first time, you know, or the first time in a long time, Leicester had to go through this where everyone thought they'd mess it up. Man City, everyone thought they had messed it up in 2012, and then they won. You know, Chelsea, you know, a couple of times as well. This, you know, you have to go through these doubts. Even if they lose at the Etihad, as you said off air, we were talking about this earlier, you said that they can go for it.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a really interesting game. But I still think Man City win the title at the end of the season just because logic suggests that they will. But that's what this whole last couple of years, logic hasn't really come into it because two teams have been much better than anyone predicted they would be, but also anyone thought that they could be.
Yeah, I think I do honestly think a lot of it will depend on tonight. I think if Liverpool win, I think they have enough wiggle room to drop points and still win the title. I don't, you know, if they win, what the gap be if they win today?
Four. If they win 10
points. Yeah. I think even for a side as good as City, I don't see Liverpool dropping 10 points. I just don't. If that becomes four, all of a sudden Liverpool lose to someone like, for example, Palace, where they have a terrible record, and they draw against United, which are two plausible things, there's 4 points. So I do think this game is bigger than a lot of people are giving it credit for.
Don't want to go into too much detail.
Yeah, but I think City will win it. I think City will win the league.
Okay. Finally, just a quick wrap up on. I did want to talk to you about Pulisic, because does that mean Hazard's going to Real Madrid? Does Pulisic demand that fee? Is he better than Sancho? There's a lot of questions around Pulisic. So it's an interesting conversation to have just to finish the podcast off. What do you think?
I mean, I don't think... So, let's unpack that, right? I don't think it necessarily means Hazard's going anywhere. He was approached by Chelsea. Chelsea wanted to get the deal done in the summer, which would indicate... Which means he's been a fairly long-term target for them. And it may be as an insurance to in case Hazard leaves, but it doesn't necessarily mean he is about to leave, which I think is what some people are trying to say.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it means a move to Real Madrid is imminent. I think they're just being smart about it, thinking, well, we know that this is something that's been talked about a lot. We know of Hazard's desire to eventually want to play for Real Madrid.
Yeah.
While the hammer's not about to fall right now, we're going to protect ourselves just in the chance that it happens soon.
Yeah.
So there's one. Is he better than Sancho? No. Is he a fantastic player? Yes. We have to remember that Pulisic is 20 years old. He moved to Dortmund at 16. He is a very, very young player. And as we talked about before, football is a business. He is the footballer that matters in the United States.
Yeah.
And I mean that with all due respect to the only two that even come close are Messi and Ronaldo. And that's because of their, you know, legendary status as two of the greatest players ever. When I lived in Florida for a year, nearly every conversation on football talk, on sports talk shows that talked about football, soccer, were nearly always framed around Pulisic. Nearly always. There would be some way of getting back, well, they talk about Messi, Ronaldo. Can Pulisic eventually be that calibre?
Yeah.
He is huge. And to take a cynical view, Chelsea have signed him because he's a fantastic player. But a nice little side bonus is that they're going to sell so many more shirts in the United States because of this. They're going to be so much more marketable in the States because of this. And, you know, I don't think he's a better player than Sancho. I don't think he will be a better player than Sancho, but he is very much a confidence football player. He's playing at Dortmund, but not as much as he would like, not as much as he was.
Because of Sancho.
And for him to lose your place to a 17-year-old who steps on the pitch and does something every single game, whether it's a goal assist or like just a lovely piece of skill and play, it's eye catching. It's demoralising. He was that player for Dortmund. He's not anymore.
Yeah.
So I think if Chelsea can put their arm around him and say, "Hey,
should Chelsea have paid that money for Sancho?"
I don't think that money gets Sancho.
What gets Sancho?
I think you're talking 75 plus.
Even though he's inexperienced, even though it still represents a huge risk.
Yeah, because of how consistently he is doing it now, because of his age. I think if you're a football analyst and you're looking at who the next potential stars are, it's him. He speaks well. He's very marketable from that point of view, and he's a great player. And I think if someone was to move him from Dortmund now, and the fee was 80 million, I wouldn't be surprised by that. In no way, shape or form.
How good are Man City then?
But yeah, they should be. But it's an example of young players taking their own career by the horns. Because Pep said to him, yeah, I'm going to include you, but not that much. Like with Phil Foden, for example. And Jadon Sancho was like, no, I'm good enough to play every week. So if I'm
Is he good enough to play every week for Man City, though?
For Man City?
Would you pick him over Sane, Mahrez and Sterling now? And the same question, would you then pick Pulisic to play over? I think if Pulisic is not a replacement for Hazard, an addition to Hazard, a way of strengthening that part of the pitch, because funnily enough, Chelsea spent millions of pounds on that area of the pitch over the years, but now they look relatively weak in terms of Hazard, Pedro's ageing and not as good as he was, and was always pretty inconsistent anyway. Willian is 30, fantastic player, but 30 years old now.
Yeah.
They needed refreshing in that area. That's a good signing. But if he is the man to replace Hazard, then suddenly it's not.
Yeah. But then I don't think there's many players who are able to replace Hazard. He is that good. Like, let's make no bones about it. He is that good. City, the difference is that is City's strong, I think City's strongest part of the pitch.
Yeah.
The wide areas. I've said before, he's more intelligent than Raheem Sterling. I think he's a better finisher than Raheem Sterling. But I don't think he would start at City just yet.
Yeah.
But I think he'd start at Chelsea.
That's pretty much all we've got time for. Thank you very much for these last two episodes, Pete.
It's been fun.
Really, really fun to be talking again. We won't put a cap on when we next be back. Hopefully we will be back. We don't know if we will or not. But thanks very much for listening, and hope you've enjoyed them. And here's to the future. See you later.